Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. It's good to have you all with us in these continuing conversations. We're about to have a conversation with Kathy Kelly. She has been a member of Voices in the Wilderness, Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's written numerous books, which we'll talk about. She was in Iraq 26 times, arrested more than 60 times at home and abroad. She is an activist for peace and justice in this world and is here in Baltimore today, so we're talking with her. She was brought to us. Rosemary Thompson, an old friend, sent an email saying that Kathy Kelly was coming to town. We'd like to interview her. And, of course, my immediate response was yes. I'm looking to meet her. It's a pleasure to have her in the studio. It's a pleasure and an honor. Kathy, welcome. Good to have you on the Mark Steiner Show.
Oh, it's very great to be here. Thank you.
So I'm always enamored of and interested in people who live their life dedicated not just nonviolence, but to nonviolent resistance, to seeing that as a path, as a way of life, as well as a political statement. Because I think it's hard for most people to put their hands around how what that means for you and how you and to put their hands around that way of living.
It doesn't seem very extraordinary to me at all, quite honestly. I suppose, I mean, I had my share of oddness as a child. I think also, you know, when I was a kid, the only professionals we ever saw were the nuns. You know, if doctors and lawyers lived in houses on streets, we didn't see them. It was, I suppose, an upper, lower middle class neighborhood on the southwest side of Chicago, working class. And the sisters ran everything. You know, they took care of the parish and the school. And if there were big problems in the neighborhood, they seemed to be helpful. But they never owned anything. I mean, they never showed the slightest interest in acquiring personal wealth. And so, I mean, now I could sort of say the IRS is my spiritual director. I've kept my salary underneath the taxable income forever, it seems.
But, you found a way not just give you money to war by having salary so low they couldn't be taxed.
And it works.
Right?
It works, yes. But then you don't own anything. But that's all right, because I never learned how to drive. And I
really,
you know, I don't want to have responsibilities to maintain a household. I deeply respect people who, you know, have chosen that way of life and are really struggling, so many people all across the country. But I've been, I suppose, in some ways, unusually able to kind of align my life with what my deepest beliefs have been. And those deepest beliefs were with me as a child, although I also had a strong dose of fatalism, you know, like, what's for you won't go past you. That's what my mother used to say. I don't know what it meant. But there was a sense that it was okay to talk about a problem, but you really couldn't try to do something about it. That would be going too far. So I can remember as a kid watching the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King do something and
right.
watching Phil Berrigan and watching Daniel Berrigan and always thinking, ooh, that's exotic. But then I kind of married into it. I married Karl Meyer, and he had been a protege of Dorothy Day and
Catholic Workers Movement.
Catholic Worker, yeah.
Right.
And then things got very, very easy. I was surrounded by people who couldn't imagine not trying to do something about the terrible problems that beset our neighborhood. I mean, I was living in the poorest neighborhood in Chicago, and how could you not?
Growing up, you did, you mean?
No, this was after I'd moved in Chicago. The poorest neighborhood on the north side was a neighborhood called Uptown. You know that neighborhood.
Yes, very well.
Now it's changed. But at the time, there was so much desperation. And so, you know, everywhere you turned, you found people rolling up their sleeves and trying to pitch in. And then also, you know, people who were trapped, couldn't get out of tremendous violence and impoverishment. So it just raised question after question after question.
So even as a young girl, the way I understood it, you went to Catholic school,
mm-hmm.
but you also, where you were kind of steeped in some of this Catholic resistance.
Yeah, I was so lucky. You know, we went half a day Catholic, half a day
That's
public.
That's what I was about to ask you, right. And yeah, public school was this integrated school that had full of racial violence, right?
Lots of problems, yeah.
Right.
And the Catholic school was more of a cocoon in some ways. Not to say that we weren't all steeped in racism and still, you know, no doubt steered in some terrible ways by a kind of a presumed racism. But the people that taught me in that Catholic school tried hard to promote the idea that we're all part of one another. So we learned about the Vietnam War, and I can just remember being in a bookstore downtown in Chicago. I'd go off to my part-time job at a shoe store or something, and I was like a magnet to this bookstore where I could look at things that Dan Berrigan had written and kind of the posters and artwork. And And it held out the possibility there might be another way.
This is when you were like 15 or 16. You were a young teenager, right?
Yeah.
So, and that obviously had a deep effect on your life and kind of helped push you in this path that's become your existence. You're one of those people who revolutionary activity and radical activity and resistance to oppression isn't something you just believe in. It's actually your life. Resisting it is your life. Trying to change it is your life.
Well, I do think that having spent time in war zones removes some doubts about vocation, if you will. I know there's nothing more important for me to do than to try to end wars and to try to alleviate suffering caused by wars. And I think in some ways that requires education, education, education. We've got to try to educate people about the consequences of our wars.
So as a woman, as an American woman, as a person who lives her life nonviolently, I'm curious what it was like, if you could describe for people what it was like. You were spent, how many times you were in Iraq, 26, 27 times, whatever that number is, in Iraq from 1990 and even through this war.
Mm-hmm.
You spent time in Swat in the valley in Pakistan in the middle of the war there against the Taliban and Pashtun land. You spent time in the Gaza Strip, in Jenin, Bosnia.
Heading to Afghanistan next week.
and Afghanistan. I left out of Afghanistan. Describe for us emotionally and also in terms of your analysis, what is it like to be in a war zone? What does it feel like to be in the war zone for you, and what comes through you out of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I could say that there's a sense of terrific and overwhelming dismay when the bombs are exploding, when you hear these sickening thuds and, you know, gut-wrenching explosions, ear-splitting blasts, and see a mother holding her child and trying to comfort the child, and the mother is saying some version of, it's okay, it's okay. And you see on her face just stark, terrible fear. And there's this sense of that war won't be over when it's over, not for the mother, not for the child, not for the person who's dropping the bomb, not for the person in prison, not for the interrogator, not for the tortured. It's just all of these hideous patterns get reinforced into more and more suffering. And it's so unnecessary. 95% of our problems are solved nonviolently. You know,
what do you mean by that, given the way?
Well, if you and I get into a really profound disagreement, I am not going to break your nose. I know I'll never do it. So relax, all right?
Thank you. I feel much better now.
And you can't break mine, yeah. So that's the way we figure out ways to solve problems. And yet, when it comes to foreign policy, it's just like there's a regression to something so barbaric as to a slaughter, untold numbers of people. I mean, when you think of World War I and World War II combined, 91 million people killed. And war isn't over when it's over. We know that. And I think that the war profiteers are so enamored and so dependent on their welfare relationship to ongoing wars that rational thought and compassion and their deepest values get somehow suspended or put inside the closet and locked up. And then the marketers, the think tankers, figure out ways to market these wars to the U.S. public. And I think, you know, you hear Chomsky say, hey, look, you know, sports are not so great. There's a lot of jingoism in our national sports. But you do find that people talk back to the sportscaster and they analyze and they think hard. And they, you know, if we could just manage to, it's like trying to turn a big, huge construction machine around without any power steering. How can we turn the U.S. public opinion? But I was so encouraged. David Cameron, the prime minister of the United Kingdom, was so angry when the United States didn't go to war against Syria. And part of it was that the members of parliament hadn't authorized it. And he said, the well of public opinion has been right well poisoned against war. He then went on to say, by the Iraq episode. But how about that, if the well of public opinion has been poisoned against war?
And it's interesting that the well of public opinion we're talking about is British and American. who didn't experience war very much.
Well, I think the Brits have certainly got
more than
lots
we because
of
they
generational.
With the Irish and the British fighting in the 60s and 70s, they did feel some of that. But for the most part, you know, Americans and most people have not in Europe felt.
In this very modern,
right.
And as we move into the 21st century. Well, I think that's true. In some ways, I also think, though, that part of the idealism I felt as a youngster was the war on poverty. We were going to get rid of poverty, we'd eradicate disease, and then.
Right.
And now I think there's been a war against impoverished people in this country. And Michelle Alexander has been so brilliant with the new Jim Crow in helping us understand how it's not only poverty, it's a systematized effort to assure that African-American people will never be able to rise into a safer, a more secure kind of community living, because there's now a kind of a new reenactment of enslavement. And so we do experience that. We do see it. We know that there's so many direct relations. I mean, every year, every university graduates a new generation of lawyers. Every university. How are you going to keep all those lawyers employed? Prisoners. And so we have this military-industrial security congressional media complex going on. And it affects so many of our lives in terms of income and job capacity and education. But as long as there's this huge pool of unemployed and unemployable people who've been ruined by the war against the poor in this country, then the profiteers can say, don't talk to us about minimum wage. So I don't know. I think we are very tied into a warlike mentality when it comes to our foreign policy and economy.
I think you're right. And I think that we don't often make the connection between the impoverishment of people in America, the increasing impoverishment of people in America, the fear of it, and a war economy. Those things are never really put together for most people.
Yeah, how would we ever find the wherewithal, the resources, the ingenuity, the scientists to deal with the real terror we're all facing, which is the terror of what we're doing to our own environment, unless we take the money away from the Pentagon? I mean, it's like a vacuum cleaner. They take so much of it. And, you know, when I go over to Afghanistan, I'll be with a group of teenagers, and they are quite sure they want to live without war because they've seen it firsthand. You know, Faiz's brother was killed before his eyes. Abdul Hai and Zarguna and Hamajan each lost their father. You know, each of these youngsters have directly sustained the pain and the suffering. And then they're listening to the mothers in the neighborhood come and say, I think I'm losing my mind. And why? And it's the same answer. I can't feed my children, from Nuri, from Nakhmat, from Fatima. So these youngsters, they're so impressive to me. They kind of digested it. They thought about it. And they thought, well, what can we do? We must be able to do something. And they've figured out a way to employ the seamstresses, the women as seamstresses, making the heavy blankets that are so desperately needed, because the war displaces 400 people every day into overcrowded, squalid, wretched refugee camps in major cities. And Kabul just has many thousands of people living out in the snow and the ice with the most fragile of protection. And so these heavy blankets make a very big difference. So they've taught me a lot, you know, not to get frozen in a kind of mesmerized sense of, well, you can't do anything about it, not to sink into fatalism, but to try to do what you can.
How did you end up in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, it was Bob Cook. He's one of yours. He's with the Pax Christi group here. And we were fasting in relation to Guantanamo. And he would never raise his voice, but you could tell he really wanted our attention. And he said, do you understand there are teenagers in the mountains in central Afghanistan fasting with you? They're living in a pup tent and they're accompanying you on this fast. And we said, really? And he said, well, if you'd read your email, you'd know about it. And so they were trying to get our attention. So we did a Skype phone call with them, and it happened to be Martin Luther King's birthday. So Carmen Trotter from the Catholic Workers said, you know, it's Martin Luther King's birthday. Do you think I could talk about that with these kids? And I said, sure, go right ahead. So he started to tell them who Martin Luther King was. And there was a commotion at the other end. And these kids huddled around a cell phone in one of the poorest areas of Afghanistan are trying to figure out which one is going to be the first to give a memorized quote from a speech by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And
Were they speaking English or were they speaking
Well, Pashtun? They have a wonderful translator and mentor. His name is Hakim. He's a medical doctor from Singapore. He's kind of like Albert Schweitzer and Gandhi and Mother Teresa rolled into one.
And where is this in Afghanistan?
Well, now they're in Kabul, but at the time they were in Bamyan. And
Bamyan,
it's such
yeah.
a beautiful area of the world, but oh, so poor. They have no electricity. None. 11 years of occupation and no lights. And
none.
They don't have latrines in many places and they don't have jobs. And so these are, you go over there and they'll just swing your suitcase on their back and say, I am mountain boy. They're very strong.
Because we hear in the news about the statues of Buddha blown up in Bamyan.
Yeah, that's right there.
Right?
Yeah.
Those ancient statues.
They did? There's scaffolding in front of the remains, and they climbed the scaffolding, and they managed to rig up kind of a light system so that the Dari word for peace would be radiating all throughout the mountainside.
Oh, these
in front of the Buddha
statues. They speak
Dari,
not Pashtun, where you were.
Right.
Okay.
In Kabul also, predominantly Dari is spoken. It's a derivative of Farsi. And
right.
So they're trying now to learn Pashtun because they're living together inter-ethnically.
With
it would
Pashtuns.
Be like my old students, the Harrison Jensen, the Latin Kings in Chicago, trying
right.
to live together. And that's what they're trying to do.
Because these are the Hazara people.
Exactly.
Right?
The Hazaras
right.
and the Tajiks and the Pashtuns. And they've been told by their elders, forget it. This is not on. You can't do this.
No, they are our enemies. We have to kill each other.
And they've said, no, we want to live without war. We want to understand forgiveness. They pore over picture books of Gandhi and King. And they get it.
In the midst of that, that's very difficult to do. I mean, I think there's when you tell a story like that, there's a difference between somebody who sits down for nonviolent resistance in the United States of America. You may get your head beat in by a police officer, may get hurt, being arrested or whatever. Not saying that's not an act, a brave act. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that mm-hmm. that's different than when you're describing people who are Hazara people who are in Afghanistan, who are a minority there, and Shiites living in this overwhelming Sunni country as well, in the hills, from a culture that's a warrior culture, as are the Pashtuns and Tajiks, saying no to mm-hmm. war and living a life of peaceful, nonviolent resistance. That's
stunning.
That's amazing.
It is.
To think about it that way, the way to what you're describing.
Well, one of the things that gave me a great deal of hope was hearing one of the elders, and young people are not usually heard from in that context either,
right.
or in that culture. You wait until you're older before you speak up. But one of the elders said to Abdul Hai, you don't know what you're talking about. And Abdul Hai said, but Fida, I do know my father was killed by the Taliban. And Fida was so angry, this older man. He said, well, they should have killed you too. And there was this gasp. And the young ones stayed up, I think for a couple of hours, trying to figure out what happened to Fida that made him so readily angry like that. And then they each contributed what they knew. And Fida had been in a refugee camp, and Fida had lost his brother. And so they really tried to sense what were all the sufferings and pains he'd borne. And the next day, there's Fida crossing the street. And the streets are horrid. They're just awful. They're filled with slime and sludge. And I saw Abdul Hai pick up his pace, and he and Zekrullah were at each elbow, helping Fida get across the street, making sure his briefcase wouldn't get splattered. So that gave me a lot of hope.
Now, you also spent a lot of time, I think it's important to talk about your time in Iraq.
Mm.
From the beginning of the Gulf War, is that right?
1990? In 1990, yeah. Well, actually, no, I didn't get there till 1991.
Okay.
The Gulf Peace Team set up camp in 1990, and there were 25 people from the United States who were part of that encampment of ultimately 88 people. And we were in a desert camp when the war began, and eventually we were evacuated to Baghdad while the war was still going on. And then the Iraqis said, no, we have to get you out of the country, and they evacuated us out. But they did let us come in with convoys of very minimal relief supplies. So that's when we first started breaking the sanctions. It was so far down the list of things that we were thinking about at the time, and I was sure those economic sanctions would be lifted by the time I got home. 13 years of economic warfare against children, you know, the people that were primarily punished by the most comprehensive economic sanctions ever imposed in modern history were children under age 5. A British nurse I know sat next to me in a pediatric ward, Martin Thomas, and he looked around at all the mothers who were holding their children or trying to swat flies off their children's faces, and no antibiotics and no anesthetics. And finally, Martin said, "I think I understand. It's a death row for infants, isn't it?" And that was right, a death row for infants. And people in the United States weren't allowed to know. It was so eclipsed from the media. We tried hard. We really did. It's the greatest disappointment of my adult life. We didn't succeed to lift those economic sanctions. And then followed bombing and civil war and so much punishment on people who meant us no harm.
Some I can hear people hearing this conversation we're having because, I mean, you, let's just take Iraq for an example, as we're talking about now, that involved from the sanctions, the first Gulf War, the you were there in the beginning of the bombing of Iraq. You were, am I correct?
We stayed there throughout the 2003 Shock and Awe bombing.
And you were there in Baghdad.
Yeah.
And you greeted the American troops, if I read right.
Oh, that's true.
And, right? When they came in.
They were thirsty, and we came down with water.
For the American troops?
Yeah.
Some people I can hear hearing this going, even if I'm against the war in Iraq, Saddam Hussein was a madman. And, you know, conversations you have with some Iraqis will say, yeah, he was crazy. I was tortured by Saddam. My family was killed by Saddam. He dropped gas on people. He was a thug. And then you talk to other Iraqis who will say how these wars have torn apart a society where, as in Baghdad, 70% of the marriages were mixed marriages between Sunni and Shia people, that they lived together in a very different way before the war started, much like Sarajevo before that war started.
Mm-hmm.
So this, what I'm saying is there are a lot of contradictions in this, you know, and how you stand up to a tyranny like Saddam's, how people in Iraq do that, and why people are... You can't kind of figure out what is the role there of somebody who is living, who's kind of approaching this through nonviolent action. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think in the overarching historical analysis, three little words, don't support dictators. The United States was of great support to Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. And believe it or not, the economic sanctions, in a way, helped sustain Saddam's dictatorship. I mean, if you want to end support for a cruel and a brutal dictatorship, then help the people who are living under that dictatorship maintain, as best they can, education, communication, and social services. The economic sanctions ravaged all three. The economic sanctions assured that people in Iraq would no longer have social services or education or any communication with the outside world. They were totally isolated. Well, this helped Saddam Hussein maintain power. And besides that, the United States had actually given air cover for Saddam Hussein when his attack helicopters had lifted off the ground in Baghdad in 1991 and mowed down people who were in Shia groups who thought, okay, this is our chance. Let's rise up. So I think...
Because they thought they had a promise from the West
exactly.
to support them.
And then they were mowed down and they were imprisoned and
right.
they were tortured. And so the United States did not play any kind of a role that could be discerned as humanitarian in its years of wanting to remove Saddam Hussein, supposedly. I think... If they wanted Saddam out, they could have gotten him out. But I don't think they wanted that. I think they wanted to make sure that the economic sanctions continued to cripple Iraq so that it would never again be a threat to any neighboring countries, whether you're looking at Saudi Arabia or Israel, which is in the area, or Kuwait. And I think it's also been assigned to other countries all around the world. If you think that you can excuse yourselves from subordinating your country to serve U.S. national interests. Don't forget what happened to Iraq. Now, that sounds like such a menacing, bullying posture. We can't believe that of the United States. And by and large, it's, I think, certainly not characteristic of U.S. people. And that's why those whose job is to market the war will always try to put a humanitarian cast to it. Well, we had to go to war against Saddam because he was cruel and evil, and we had to save people from Saddam. We had to go to war against Afghanistan. Well, the reasons change and change, but lately it's been because the Taliban are so awful, and we have to save the women and save the children. 1 million children are suffering from acute malnourishment in the south of Afghanistan, in exactly the spot where there's the biggest U.S. troop concentration. 1 out of 11 Afghan women dies in childbirth, a tortuous way to die. Major cities have some electricity, but I'm heading over to Kabul, and they're saying, you know, dress warm. We're getting electricity every other day, if we're lucky, in the neighborhood where I stay. And, you know, the water is connected to the well, and the well is connected to electricity. You wipe out the electricity, the water is impure, the gastrointestinal disease is spread. 26 people in a Kabul refugee camp froze to death, 8 of them children, and the refugee camp is right across the road from a big, huge U.S. military base. And the trucks go in all day long carrying food and fuel and clean water. So people begin to wonder, do U.S. people think that they're somehow a different species from the rest of us?
What do you think? Well, just made me think of a vision of what would happen if you turned the trucks around and moved into the refugee camp and brought food supplies. And
well, you know what? The drug lords would be upset if you didn't take them along the routes where the drug lords all get paid a toll for every stretch of road that those trucks move along. So actually, the trucking of supplies to the U.S. bases has put money in the pockets of the very warlords and drug lords that supposedly the United States is fighting against. But what's under the Hindu Kush Mountains? Rare earth elements, rare earth metals. What's surrounding the Caspian Sea Basin? Natural gas and fossil fuels. And the United States doesn't want China or Russia to have cheaper access to those resources. And so the slaughter goes on.
I think that's important what you just said to explain that, because people, I think that's something that gets lost in all of this. I mean, it gets lost, the what's really happening and why it's happening and what's there. These rare earth minerals are the gas of the 21st century. It's the oil of the 21st century, I mean to say.
Yeah, and of course, the young ones in Afghanistan that I know, they understand this. It's not lost on them.
You keep moving and going. You don't stop the process of what you believe in and going, whether it's in the United States of America, around Guantanamo or poverty in this country, or whether you're in Iraq or Afghanistan. I think people have, you know, I read an article the other day by a young man who was one of the people who was part of Occupy. And it was a very depressing article. He thought, well, you know, we didn't topple Wall Street. We didn't stop. We didn't stop what we wanted to stop, because I think there's a kind of a shallowness in terms of our sense of history and what the struggle for change means. And, you know, it's not like today. And what you're describing in terms of what you do is kind of understanding of the continuum of what it means to stand up, to face it.
I think it's important not to let inconvenience interfere with living in accord with our deepest beliefs.
That's a very important statement.
I feel humbled looking at the young people today, because they're facing, it's a pretty massive inconvenience. They're going to graduate almost like indentured servants, staggering debt and very few jobs available that would enable a young person to pay off that debt. And they may have to delay starting families, and they'll have to figure out ways to find community and love and purpose in a world that's very different from the previous generation's experiences, if they're part of the group that goes into that education track. But, you know, maybe we do have a chance now to better understand the cares and concerns of people who have always been shut out from having a fair piece of the pie, if you will. And so maybe the chance to live more simply and to share resources more equitably, to prefer service to dominance and not to ever want to be a fat cat or, I think that pendulum could swing again. We certainly do. And, you know, there was a big difference between the 50s and the 60s. Huh?
Yeah, that's true.
And that happened so quickly. So it may be that there is a different world ahead, one wherein solving the socioeconomic inequities and the problems caused by militarism and the problems caused by imminent environmental catastrophes will become of such importance that people won't be able to trifle with these bloated and outdated military tactics. That's what I'm hoping for.
You know, one of the things I just want to conclude with a little bit is also what some things you're steeped in. We started talking about this. I was reading some stuff about you and realized that one of the people that you were kind of moved by was William Stringfellow.
Oh, yeah.
This great Christian theologian.
An ethic for Christians and other strangers in an alien land. I remember that changed my life. You know what? I read it while I was baking my head under one of those ancient hair dryer things. You know, women would just trap themselves with these god-awful hair dryers. And I, you know, straightening this hair out, can you imagine? I would
Looks
have it rolled
like
up in orange juice cans. And in the middle of that book, I liberated myself. I thought, I don't have to do this anymore. So I'm sure that wasn't Bill Stringfellow's intention, but he got me out from under the hairdryer. I never went under it again.
But I think that I'd love to kind of conclude here a little bit with just that piece of the heart and root of what moves you and who you are and how that fuels not just you, others as well, but because of all the people that I've heard you've written about and that have been moved by. Most people don't know Stringfellow's work, you know, like they don't know Howard Thurman's work. People don't know the work of some of these incredible theologians who are on the side, who kind of would criticize liberal theology as much as they would criticize fundamentalist, different vision of what it meant in this case and in Thurman's case to be a Christian. Talk a bit about that, because in some ways it's the core of a lot of this for you. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Well, Jesus didn't die of old age. I think, right. You know, we weren't put on this earth to live forever. And when you get a chance, when you have the opportunity to live in accord with what you really believe, I guess I'd just say take it. And then find kindred spirits, and these kinds of communities form and give, I think, some of life's greatest gifts to us in the midst of what are some of the greatest sufferings racked upon people. So I think keep one foot planted amid the people who are bearing the worst brunts of warfare and one foot planted amid people engaged in nonviolent resistance, and that's where we'll find our equilibrium. And who knows where it's going to take you? But I hope that that kind of courage that helps us control our fears, we catch it from one another. That's what can get us through. I catch it from these kids in Afghanistan, and
well, you're off to next, right?
Yeah, and certainly in Iraq, I saw people who couldn't afford despair. You know, they were in the hospitals with children, had more children at home to take care of. And the mothers of Iraq taught us so, so much about tenacity and perseverance and love. Can you imagine? I mean, I was next to a woman who was holding a tiny, tiny plastic tube up to the nostril of her infant, and the tube was too large, and they didn't have a smaller one, and the children would not, that child would not survive. And when she realized that, my shoulder was damp from her tears. And what she said to me was, "Believe me, Miss Kathy, I pray this will never happen to a mother. She is in your country."
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of solidarity, falling in solidarity with other people, because that's what we are. You know, we're human beings, and I think we were made from love and we're made to love.
Well, Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you for your stand for resistance to oppression, to the light that you bring to us all. It's really been great to meet you and have you in the studio, Kathy Kelly.
Well, it's a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you.